Now, time and again, we hear the proponents of genetically engineered foods lament that in the case of these novel products, science has been under prolonged and serious attack. And it may surprise you to know that I fully agree with them on that point. Science has been under serious assault. However, I strongly disagree about where the assault has come from. The GMO proponents would have us believe that it's been mounted by those of us who elucidate reasons to regard these novel foods as abnormally risky. But in reality, the assault is an inside job. It's being mounted by the very scientists who purport to be defending genetically engineered foods. And in their purported defense, they're actually denigrating science, sullying the integrity of the scientific endeavor, as it probably has never been denigrated before. That's right, most of the promoters of GE foods who purport to be upholding science are in reality subverting it. Now, to be clear, I'm not claiming that every scientist who supports GE foods, again, GE meaning genetically engineered, has engaged in this unpleasant practice. But far too many of them have. And the guilty group comprises not only a substantial number of eminent scientists, but many respected scientific institutions as well. Moreover, the attack has reached epic proportions, and it may well be the biggest assault on science that has ever occurred. And ironically, that assault is being perpetrated in the name of science. Now, I realize that these assertions may strike many of you as being too bold. In fact, many of you may be getting very angry at hearing me say them. And I'm not surprised if you would be. But my book provides solid evidence that thoroughly backs up all of the assertions I've just made. I'll be discussing some of that evidence tonight, but because it's a very big book, I certainly won't have time to go through all of it. And that's why I'm glad that Robert cited David Schubert as one of the many scientists who've scrutinized the book and have praised its solidity, because his introduction may not be reaching all of those who are going to be seeing this by video. I'm going to take the liberty of repeating a few of the praises that Dr. Schubert issued for my book, because he's a molecular biologist who is a professor and a laboratory director at the prestigious Salk Institute for Biological Studies, and he has called the book incisive, insightful, and truly outstanding. He's also commended it as well-reasoned and scientifically solid. Another expert who has praised the book's solidity is John Eichard, a professor emeritus of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Missouri. And Dr. Eichard has called it a great book, and he's also stated, the evidence is comprehensive and irrefutable. The reasoning is clear and compelling. No one has documented other cases of irresponsible behavior by government regulators and the scientific establishment nearly as well as Drucker documents it here. So I'm bringing that up not only because I enjoy hearing them, but again, too, because the claims that I am making certainly would strike many, if not most people, as being quite bold. I wanted to at least let you know that scientists and experts who have scrutinized the book carefully have praised it. Now, just give one concrete example right now of the extent to which science is actually being subverted in the name of science. I would like to just mention briefly a report that was issued this spring by the Royal Society, the UK Royal Society, the world's most ancient and most respected scientific organization. And the Royal Society issued a guide to consumers, which was a series of questions and answers, that claimed to be a source of balanced, scientifically accurate information to enable the confused public to finally understand the accurate facts, science-based facts about genetically engineered foods. In July, I published a critique of that in The Ecologist. It's online, you can read it. But it demonstrates that that purported objective, scientifically based guide is filled with one misrepresentation after another, demonstrably false statements, and they've been getting away with it. So again, it's demonstrably false. I had several scientists review that before I published it. The Royal Society has been getting away, as have far too many other proponents of genetically engineered foods, with making statements that basically rest only on their authority, not on the facts. And it's only because the facts have been so astoundingly contorted that the proponents of the genetically engineered food venture have been able to pass it off as a solidly scientific endeavor. And when the facts are uncovered, untwisted, and exposed to the light of reason, it becomes clear just how substantially the endeavor departs from sound science, as assessed from the perspectives not only from biological science, but from computer science as well. And it becomes patently obvious that from each of these important perspectives, as we will see, genetically engineered foods entail unacceptable risks. Now, let's begin by looking at some of the foundational assumptions of the GE food venture and see really how flimsy they are. Now, the safety of genetic engineering was primarily premised on the presumption that the genome is a simple linear system in which the action of a single gene will not significantly impact others and will not disrupt the normal function of the cell and the organism as a whole. This was emphasized in a report issued by the Royal Society of Canada and has been recognized by many other experts. For instance, in a 2007 New York Times article, the veteran technology reporter Denise Caruso observed, quote, "The presumption that genes operate independently has been institutionalized since 1976, when the first biotech company was founded. In fact, it is the economic and regulatory foundation on which the entire biotechnology industry is built." So in this view, genes were viewed as significantly autonomous agents that add to the whole without acting holistically, because they don't express their proteins in a closely coordinated manner. However, this was not the only foundational presumption, and it was linked with some others of the same ilk. One of the most important was the notion that genes aren't arranged in an organized manner, and that the sequence in which they occur is essentially unimportant. In such a viewpoint, a gene would function just as satisfactorily if it were relocated to a different chromosome or came in front of a neighboring gene instead of after it. Giorgio Bernardi, a biologist at the University of Rome, who specializes in the study of genome evolution, refers to this position as the beanbag view of the genome, because it's like a beanbag. Shake it up, it doesn't really matter what position the various beans hold. It's still the beanbag, so it's irrelevant which bean is where. And that was the way the genome was looked at for many years, and that was a foundational assumption. Now, together, these two presumptions supported the belief that a chunk of recombinant DNA could be put into a plant's genome without inducing disturbance, because if the behavior of the native genes was largely uncoordinated and their arrangement was irrelevant, then there would be no important patterns that could be perturbed by such insertions. Accordingly, these presumptions engendered confidence in the precision of genetic engineering, because they implied that the outcome of a gene insertion would be exactly what the bioengineers expected. They bolstered the belief that the target organism would continue to function just as before, and the change would be limited to the new trait endowed by the inserted gene, which would tidally manifest without altering any of the organism's other qualities. However, there was a major drawback to these presumptions. They weren't true. These influential precepts, which provided an ideological foundation for the bioengineering venture and undergirded a massive endeavor to transform agriculture, turned out to be woefully wrong. Abundant evidence has discredited the notion that genes act independently from one another and has instead demonstrated that their actions are highly coordinated. Commenting on this evidence, Giorgio Bernardi has written that the genome must now be viewed as a, quote, integrated ensemble. Likewise, in her previously mentioned New York Times article, Denise Caruso emphasized the fact that, quote, genes appear to operate in a complex network, unquote. And she noted that the serious implications of this fact for the bioengineering venture, stating, evidence of a network genome shatters the scientific basis for virtually every official risk assessment of today's commercial biotech products, from genetically engineered crops to pharmaceuticals, unquote. Pretty powerful statement. Overwhelming evidence has also undermined the tenet that genes are randomly arranged. And by 2004, an article published in Nature Reviews Genetics could assert that this tenet was no longer tenable. Moreover, besides being discredited, these presumptions share another ignoble feature. They survived discreditation and outlived their plausible legitimacy. Despite the accumulation of undermining evidence, biotech proponents stubbornly clung to these presumptions anyway, and they exerted influence long beyond the point they rightfully should have. Moreover, even when biotech proponents have acknowledged that the premises are no longer tenable, they rarely confront the logical implications. And such disregard, denial, or avoidance in regard to the evidence was essential for maintaining faith in the venture, because its predictability and safety have always relied on the notion that the genome is largely disjointed, and the more the genome instead appears to function as a tightly coordinated system, the more potentially disruptive and unpredictable are the interventions of the bioengineers. So it's important to note that not only is the genome a tightly coordinated system, genetic engineering is a highly disruptive process. So it entails greater risk than does conventional plant breeding. And this reality has been recognized by a substantial number of scientists who operate independently of the biotech industry. Among these scientists have been the Biotechnology Task Force of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. So a fairly substantial number of scientists on the FDA studied the issue and concluded that genetic engineering is disruptive and it entails risks of unintended consequences to a much greater degree than does conventional breeding. Similar conclusion has been reached by the expert panel that produced a major report by the Royal Society of Canada. As have the FDA experts, these experts clearly concluded that genetic engineering can induce unintended and unpredictable side effects, including the production of novel toxins, allergens, or other harmful substances. And in fact, these experts stated that the default prediction, those were their words, for every genetically engineered food should be that the genetic engineering process has induced unintended side effects that have to be carefully screened by rigorous testing, including toxicological feeding studies on the whole food. That was also what the FDA scientists had concluded, as have many other scientists that concluded the same thing. In order to adequately monitor those risks and test for them, tests have to, at minimum, include toxicological feeding studies using the whole food. But unfortunately, those tests have not been done, rarely been done. Although most of the genetically engineered foods that have entered the market so far have failed to meet that standard, and we'll see even that standard is too limited, but they haven't even met that one. For instance, in the year 2000, a professor at Guelph University in Canada reviewed the 40 genetically engineered crops that had been approved in Canada for human consumption at that point. By the way, they'd all been approved, well, actually, they weren't even approved in the US, because here in the US, the FDA doesn't require one smidgen of testing. Anybody can dump any genetically engineered food on our market without so much as even informing the FDA that they're going to do it. So those foods were almost certainly already on the US market, and those 40 were on the Canadian market as of 2000, and she found in studying them that not a single one had undergone testing with the whole food, the whole engineered food product. Further, 70% had not even been subjected to any laboratory or animal toxicity testing at all. The deficiency of the regulatory system was highlighted in 2001 by that report of the Royal Society of Canada I earlier alluded to. And that report not only lamented the lack of adequate testing of biotech foods up to that point, it noted there weren't even any validated test protocols to assess their safety in a biological and statistically meaningful manner. Okay, so not only were tests not going on, they said there aren't even any valid test protocols right now to do the kinds of testing that are needed. So therefore, all of the many claims up to 2001, and there were a lot of them because genetically engineered foods started coming on the market in 1994, they were all baseless. Scientifically, they were baseless according to the expert panel of the Royal Society of Canada. Moreover, the testing has remained deficient. Thus, the European Union did not even require 90-day feeding tests using the whole food until 2013. And when such tests were voluntarily performed prior to that, it was usually not until at least 10 years after the genetically engineered food had entered the market and become widely consumed. Even more troubling, when a team of independent university scientists in Europe reviewed the data from 19 of those feeding studies that had been relied on to let crops on the market, these were on soy and corn varieties comprising 83% of the genetically engineered foods that people have been regularly eating. They found that 9% of the measured parameters, including blood and urine biochemistry and organ weights, were significantly disrupted in the animals that ate the GE feed. Moreover, the greatest disturbances were to the kidneys of the males and the livers of the females. And the scientists emphasized that because the livers and kidneys are the major reactive organs in the case of chronic food toxicity, those results should have been viewed as danger signs, something the regulators had unfortunately not seen fit to do. By the way, these findings were published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2011, solid study. Now remember, these 90-day feeding tests are medium-term. They're not long-term tests. But even if every medium-term or short-term test that has been conducted on a genetically engineered whole food had not detected any harm, and there are few that haven't, they could not have demonstrated safety because they weren't long enough. What's needed is, at minimum, 2-year studies, and I emphasize at minimum. That's just a start. And one good reason for that was provided by a team of university scientists in Europe who took one of Monsanto's variety of Roundup-resistant corn that had already been approved, been on the market, and had gone through a 90-day testing procedure, and they subjected it to 2-year testing. It was also better designed than Monsanto's because it could distinguish between the effects of the Roundup herbicide and the genetically engineered food even when unsprayed. And what was discovered was both the Roundup and the food itself, even if it hadn't been sprayed with Roundup, both created statistically significant problems for for the laboratory animals that had to eat it. And those problems involved significant injury to the livers and the kidneys, increased mortality, also statistically significant damage to pituitary glands and for the females to mammary tissues. So the testing hasn't been very good. And I'll just summarize with the conclusions of a few experts who've thoroughly studied the tests. One is David Schubert of the Salk Institute, whom I mentioned previously. He stated, as a medical research scientist who published a comprehensive peer-reviewed critique of genetically modified food safety testing, I can state confidently that it is false to say such foods are extensively tested and have been proved safe. And perhaps an even more damning quote has come from Michael Antonio, a molecular geneticist with the University of London. Now, Dr. Antonio is not against all genetic engineering. In fact, he employs genetic engineering routinely in his work. He's trying to use it to investigate and cure human genetic diseases. So he uses it, he's not completely against it, but he has come to the conclusion it's not a wise idea to apply it in producing food, certainly not with the kinds of testing that have been in place to date. And he has studied those tests thoroughly. He's co-authored a book with another molecular biologist titled GMO Myths and Truths, an excellent resource, I highly recommend it. Dr. Antonio has stated, if the kind of detrimental effects seen in animals fed genetically engineered food were observed in a clinical setting, the product's use would be halted and further research instigated to determine the cause and to find solutions. However, what repeatedly happens in the case of GE food is that despite increasing evidence of serious adverse health test results, government and industry continue unabated with the development, endorsement, and marketing of these foods as if nothing had happened, to the point they even seem to ignore the results of their own research. And he put an exclamation mark after that one. There is clearly a pressing need for independent research into the potential ill effects of GE food, and this research must include extensive animal and human feeding trials. Now, it's important to note, he said human feeding trials too, because there haven't been any clinical trials on humans yet. In fact, even the tests for the animals, as I've been stating, have been inadequate. But Dr. Antonio and several other experts believe that there would have to be, at minimum, the same kind of testing of genetically engineered foods as happens in the case of pharmaceutical drugs. And when we examine this issue from the standpoint of software engineering, you'll understand why. So this is a strong statement. It's very important that it be fully understood, I think, and digested. So it's quite evident that from the standpoint of biological science, the process through which almost all the genetically engineered foods currently on the market have been produced entails abnormal risks. And it's evident that these risks have not been properly screened via rigorous testing. And that alone is more than enough to show that they shouldn't be on the market. The case becomes far more compelling when we analyze genetic engineering from the standpoint of software engineering. Now you might be wondering, well, is that really relevant? It certainly is. Consider, both fields are dealing with complex information systems. And computer scientists, software engineers, have learned quite a bit over the years. They've learned it the hard way about the inherent risks of altering the systems. You know, they don't just design the systems, they also perform refinements on those systems. They do that periodically. And they've learned something very interesting. There is no such thing as a precise surgical revision of a big, complex information system. Even if the human mind designed it from scratch, and even if the software engineer, the programmers who designed the system are the ones making the change, presumably, they know everything that there is to know about the architecture of the system, the components, and how those components are supposed to interact as a system. But they've learned something that surprised them initially and that they've had to learn to live with and actually to adapt to, and they have, that even the presumably most precise surgical revision made to one of these systems for the purpose of improving performance can be presumed to have disrupted something else in the system in an unpredictable way. They've learned that. In fact, it's become their default presumption that if you make, no matter how small and presumably precise the change, if the system is big enough and complex enough, which most of them are by now, it's actually become nonlinear. It can't behave fully the way it's designed to. In a sense, the systems develop a life of their own. There are interactions that can occur anytime an alteration is made that transcend the ability of the system's designers to predict properly. In fact, generally, if one discovers a bug in a system, the general advice is ignore it, because it's better to know about a bug and work around it than to fix it and create another bug or bug somewhere else that you don't know about that could mess you up even worse. So that's become the default way of proceeding in the field of software engineering. Now, it's important to point out, can't be overemphasized, this happens to systems that were created by the human mind. This happens to systems, and here's another important point. Because software engineers progressively learned about the tendency of large complex systems to become nonlinear, to behave in unpredictable ways when they are revised, they progressively became smarter about the way they designed the systems. And they began to try to isolate components of the system that are designed to operate together and that should operate together, and as much as possible insulate them from components of the system that shouldn't be interacting with those systems. And what they were trying to do was get away from code that they have derisively termed spaghetti code. Now, picture, if you will, a big steaming plate of spaghetti. You know all about it. If you take one strand and try to work on it, pull it out separate from the other ones, first, you cannot actually see exactly where that strand goes and all of the other strands it interacts with. You've got to start pulling it out just to free it. And as you pull it, you probably are going to disrupt some of the other strands. So even if they like pasta, software engineers try to avoid what they call spaghetti code. The more interrelated the code is in ways that it really doesn't need to be, the more it's like spaghetti. What they aim for is, to use another pasta analogy, ravioli code. So again, picture raviola. They're little pockets of pasta in which are encased cheese and sometimes meat or vegetables, but they want to, as much as possible, just as those ingredients, the meat and the vegetables, are encased inside the pasta, and you can pick up a ravioli without disturbing the other ones, that's what they're aiming for. Of course, they still have to have some coordination between the systems, so they have to design a system that is as much as possible like ravioli, but still maintains a letter of interconnectivity with which no plate of ravioli has ever been endowed. So but they've gotten pretty good at it, but even so, even when they have designed a system as much as they can to insulate different parts from one another that shouldn't be interacting, they can't completely rule out such interactions. They've learned that too. So they do not presume that they can. Let me say, there are two basic forms of software when it comes to safety analysis: life critical and non-life critical. Life critical, as its name implies, is software that if it has bugs and it malfunctions, then human life can be lost. And non-life critical is, it might make you mad, like when your word processing program all of a sudden you've got the blue screen. And actually, it could kill people through the aggravation, but there's ostensibly it's not life critical. It's life frustrating, but it's not life critical. Life, like the software that runs an airplane, that is an airplane's guidance system, or the software, the program that runs a pacemaker, or the program that runs an X-ray diagnostic machine or an X-ray therapy machine. Those programs are all life critical. And in fact, it's been known when there have been software malfunctions in an X-ray machine, a critical overdose was given, people were harmed. X-ray therapy machine, there have been some bugs in the software, people have died. And of course, you don't have to imagine much to know what happens if there are bugs in an airplane guidance system. So in those cases, not only is there a standard level of testing after any change, even if the revision is supposed to improve performance, there's rigorous retesting. It's called regression testing, and it is very rigorous. Rounds and rounds of testing, as much as possible. Those software engineers want to put that system through as many possible permutations and combinations as possible. Even permutations and combinations that have very low probability of ever being encountered in real world, but they don't want to take the chance that that could happen and there could be a bug. So it's an extremely arduous series of tests that they go through. Here's another interesting fact. Because, actually this is the case for critical, for life critical and non-life critical software, because software development companies want to eliminate bugs as much as possible, they have a special, they put a lot of attention and money into testing, and both in the development phase, but again, in after any revision. And they make sure, to make sure the testing is done in a rigorous manner, they have a separate department for testing. And the software engineers that test the product are separate from the developers. Why? Because it's obvious. If the people, the people who've developed the program are also in charge of testing it, they have a built-in prejudice of wanting to show the system was good. I mean, they did it. They don't want to show there are bugs. So it's just human nature. And so they separate that out. So the people doing the testing, that's their sole job, and they want to find products. They want to find problems. That's what they're paid to do. They feel good when they can find problems. So that's why, another reason that testing is highly rigorous. Now, if we back up for a moment and compare what the scenarios that we've just described, which are true ones, with what's going on in the laboratories of the genetic engineers, we'll find some shocking discrepancies. Okay. First, on the level of the code itself, the programs themselves, the bioengineers did not create the programs they're dealing with. In fact, they couldn't have, could not have created them. In fact, it's very difficult for the human mind to even comprehend them in a more than superficial way. And as the earlier part of this talk showed, the earlier presumptions about them back from the 70s were wrong, the basic presumptions. In fact, biologists are continually learning the extent to which we've been wrong about how they've been wrong about how they've been conceiving the genome. And it continues to happen. Year after year, there are new discoveries that overturn the accepted wisdom. Now, also, the bioinformation programs are much bigger than any human-made program, and they're far more complex. What kind of testing has been going on? Well, we just reviewed, it's very inferior compared to the known risks. Who's been doing the testing? For the most part, the testing has been conducted by the manufacturers of the products, either by people on their staff or people they hire. And research has shown, not surprisingly, that when tests are, in this field, actually pharmaceuticals, food additives, when tests are conducted by scientists who are one way or the other under the control of the manufacturer, they tend to find positive results, I mean favorable results, to a greater degree than when testing is conducted by independent scientists who are not under the thumb in any way or influence of the manufacturer. Not surprising, but that's been verified in good studies that have been published in peer-reviewed journals. So again, there's a very difference, great difference in the quality and of the testing and the commitment to making sure that the testing is rigorous. Now, I'd like to explore more deeply just the knowledge deficit between genetic engineering, the programs that the genetic engineers are altering. So again, they're not creating the programs, they're just making revisions. And they're not minor surgical revisions, although they claim they are. Genetic engineering up to now has been a very crude process, despite all the claims that it's precise. It hasn't been. The genetic engineers have not been able to control where the packets of added DNA go, and they haven't been able to adequately predict the side effects, because it's very difficult, and they haven't been rigorously trying to detect what the side effects are. So, and those programs, as I said, are vast, really in many ways unfathomable. And I'd like to give you just a few examples from some scientists who have contemplated these differences. We could say high complexity, low comprehensibility. Those terms describe the bioinformation systems. In fact, here's a very important point. Most geneticists will still talk about genes as if they're giving the instructions, genes as if they are somehow controlling things and the locus of control. But for many years, the evidence has been there that the genes really aren't the active agents as much as they're acted upon. And that the instructions, to the extent there are instructions in the bioinformation systems, are dispersed often throughout the genome, even throughout the cell. And evidence of dispersed bioprogram was already strong by the last decade of the 20th century. And its significance was examined in an influential article published in Nature Biotechnology in 1997 by Richard Stroman, a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Berkeley. And in it, Stroman explained that although mainstream molecular biology had for more than 40 years portrayed genes as the ultimate agents controlling life's processes, exerting their control by issuing the key commands within the cellular program, this portrayal was highly inaccurate. He pointed out that, quote, the real secrets of life, unquote, cannot be found at the level of the genetic agents, but instead at the level of the rules, this is a quote, the rules and constraints that organize genetic agents into functional arrays. And he noted that not only is this level of gene management a higher level than the one at which gene expression occurs, it is not confined within the DNA, but is, quote, coextensive with the cell itself. Moreover, he emphasized that the dynamics operating at this level are different than those at the lower one, and that the interactions are far more complex to the extent of being ultimately, and this is his quote, a quote, transcalculational, which, as he noted, is a mathematical term for mind-boggling. Okay. So in the case of human-made computer code, we've got code that is mind-made, mind-comprehended, mind-made, and here with nature's software, mind-boggling. In a subsequent paper, Dr. Stroman elaborated on these themes, emphasizing the importance of the factors that are not determined by DNA sequences, termed epigenetic factors. He was one of the first scientists to emphasize the importance of epigenetic factors, those factors that are beyond the genome, outside of the genes themselves. And many of you have heard about the importance of these factors. And he emphasized our deficient understanding of how they operate. He noted that many biologists worldwide have known for decades that genetics alone is not sufficient to explain life's complex outcomes, and that another kind of information management system must be present. And he then continued, quote, this second informational system is coextensive with the cell itself and consists of many interconnected signaling pathways, close quote. And he emphasized, here's another quote, the key concept here is that dynamic epigenetic networks have a life of their own. They have network rules not specified by DNA, and we do not understand these rules. Now, another scientist who has emphasized these themes is Evelyn Fox Keller, a professor of the history and philosophy of science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She has repeatedly pointed out that the cell's information program extends well beyond the gene and far beyond our comprehension. In her book, The Century of the Gene, she quotes a statement made by the president of the National Academy of Sciences in 1998 that, quote, "We always underestimate the complexity of life, even of the simplest processes." And she shows how a substantial amount of such underestimation has occurred by overestimating the role of genes. Like Stroman, she emphasizes that an organism's development and coherent functioning are primarily coordinated not by the genes themselves, but by, quote, "the complex regulatory mechanisms that, in their interactions, determine when and where a particular gene will be expressed," close quote. And she emphasizes that these interactions are not a fixed system, they're fluid, that in one way, she said, the program may be irreducible in the sense that nothing less complex than the organism itself is able to do the job, close quote. So she notes that instead of being bound by the genome, the program is essentially everywhere. That gives some flavor of how difficult it should be to make a revision with some adequate prediction of what the side effects might be. If software engineers can't even make a minor surgical prediction to programs that they themselves have written, how much more in the dark are the bioengineers, although they purport to have everything under control, that everything they're doing is precise, predictable, no worry, no risk, to the extent that the FDA says, we presume they're all safe, no testing at all is needed. In fact, in the case of the FDA, it's so gross because there's one division of the FDA that understands the risks inherent in altering complex information systems. That's the Division of Medical Devices. And the Division of Medical Devices, which regulates changes in programs to pacemakers and x-ray machines, they demand, they mandate that after any minor change, whole rigorous series of regression testings being done. They will not take any hypothetical arguments as to why there should be safety, as why the new system should be viewed as substantially equivalent to the old one. They're deaf to all of that. They say, do the tests, demonstrate it's safe. That's what they want, the hard evidence through hard, rigorous testing. But if we go down the hall to the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, we find a whole different view of what are the risks of altering complex information systems, the life information systems that guide the development and operation of fruits and vegetables and grains. They will say, no, if you make a change the way you're doing it, we presume you haven't made any abnormal changes at all. You don't have to do any testing at all. I mean, is that institutional schizophrenia or what? I mean, and which division is acting more in line with our best scientific knowledge? I think you all know the answer to that one. If anybody wants to say the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, I'd love to hear your reasoning on that one. So, I mean, that gives you a sense of how really disjointed and unscientific the regulatory approach to genetic engineering has been, because in a sense, they're complete ignoring all of the hard-learned lessons of software engineering, which are extremely relevant, probably even more as relevant as any evidence from the field of biology. And that's been ignored. In fact, there's an entire chapter of my book titled Overlooked Lessons from Computer Science. Subtitle is The Inescapable Risks of Altering Complex Information Systems. And those risks are inescapable. Computer science has learned that, even in human-made systems. So that lesson is far more relevant to the bioinformation systems, but has been almost completely overlooked, which is pretty astounding and deplorable. Oh, I was going to mention, because I want to give credit to my wife on something. I consider my wife one of the wittiest women on the planet. And she would read the drafts of the chapters before I'd submit them to the Sinus on the Review Committee. And Jonathan Latham is here tonight, and his wife, Allison Wilson, who has a PhD in molecular biology from Cornell, was one of the scientists on the review team and gave me excellent feedback. But my wife, after she read, it just so happened that that chapter on the overlooked lessons from computer science was chapter 11. And when Catherine, after she read the draft, she said to me, your chapter 11 is going to drive Monsanto into chapter 11. So anyway, and that may well, that prediction may well come to pass if enough people of influence read the book, and especially that chapter. In fact, if Bill Gates, Bill and or Melinda Gates, were to read that chapter, I think it might change what they're doing, because they're very intelligent software engineers. They are investing massive amounts of their foundation's money into the development and the promotion of genetically engineered foods. And as most of you know, this university is receiving quite a bit of their largesse. They're funding the so-called Alliance for Science here, which I think a strong case could be made that the alliance with science is not all that strong. They've also donated to develop, to build Gates Hall, which is where the computer science wing is. So I really think it would be great if the people from that hall actually scrutinized what the people in the Alliance for Science are promoting, scrutinize it according to what has been learned by computer science, and then have a vigorous dialogue. Yet that has to be happening. You know, there can't continue to be this separation between the experts in computer science and the people that are altering the most complex and least understood bioinformation systems on the planet. There just should be much greater harmony between the two. Of course, if that happened, what would be learned is that there is really no safe way to do genetic engineering. Because as I mentioned earlier, even without taking into account computer science, scientists like Michael Antonio and several others have concluded we would at minimum need the same kind of testing as occurs in pharmaceutical drugs. Well, that will not happen as a practical matter. Consider this. It takes many, many years, I think at least 12 years on average, maybe more, correct me if I'm wrong, for a pharmaceutical drug to go through all the R&D, all the testing, and get to the point where it can be approved. And that costs a lot of money. One reason that the pharmaceutical industry gives for the high prices that their patents allow them to charge until the generics come out, is, or even after, is we have to recoup all of our R&D costs, our research and development costs. Well, they can charge a premium for pharmaceuticals. There's only so much you can charge for broccoli, you know, for soybeans. There's a limit to how much you... So the testing as it is more than they want to pay, and that's why they try to skimp on the testing. If every genetically engineered food had to go through the same kind of testing as pharmaceuticals, the industry couldn't survive that. I have a feeling, too, that they couldn't survive it just on the level of the test result, what the test results would show, especially if the tests were done in a rigorous way by independent scientists. But from the standpoint of software engineering, to have testing that came anywhere near commensurate to the rigor with which life-critical software programs are tested after even a minute revision, it would have to probably be even beyond pharmaceutical tests, that level of clinical testing. So anyway, the practicalities are that if these products were tested adequately in a scientifically sound manner, the system would be breaking, the whole venture would collapse. Just admitting that such testing was needed would collapse it, because it would refute all of the claims on which they've been based. Now, just before I wrap up, I want to deal with, because perhaps some of you might be thinking, well, so far you've been really talking about the kinds of cruder genetic engineering that have been used up till now. But we've all heard about recent developments that are supposed to be revolutionizing everything to make things truly precise. You know, it's interesting, they've been claiming that genetic engineering was completely precise. Now they're saying these new technologies, particularly CRISPR, many of you have heard of that. I'm not even gonna try to state all the technical words that that acronym stands for, but it is a purported gene editing technique. It's supposed to be extremely precise, where there's an RNA guide that will guide, be able to go right to a specific gene, even a specific nucleotide, and then there's a cutting, a protein that can cut there and delete something or cut and have something added. And they claim this is really precise. Well, I guess that meant what came before wasn't all that precise, or there wouldn't have been that much room for improvement. So, but is this as precise? Well, first, just from the standpoint of, again, what biology, Jonathan Latham has recently written a brilliant article published in Independent Science News called God's Red Pencil? The subtitle is something to the effect, and you can tell me specifically, exploding the myths of precise gene editing. What is the exact subtitle?
It was the myths of precise gene editing.
Okay. I was close enough, I think he said. So anyway, I recommend you read that because he shows that this CRISPR is having off-target effects, but even if it hadn't, you can't predict. They don't know what these side effects are going to be yet of making the changes they're doing. And certainly from the software perspective, we know they never could. Again, we have to consider that from the standpoint of software engineering. We would have to presume that whatever happens with CRISPR has to be treated at least like a case of making even the most precise change to a life-critical program. Rigorous regression testing is needed, and there are sounder reasons in the case of doing some change to a bioinformation system. But here's another very important point. Even if, okay, the editing were really precise editing, if everything that they say is going to happen were precise and predictable, there's something they don't mention, and that is when they're operating on an isolated cell, they're making a change to a cell that's been isolated from a mature organism. That cell can't be planted in the ground and grow into a mature plant. No way. In fact, they have to put it through a process called tissue culture, which is highly unnatural and creates a lot of disruptions, many mutations. In fact, some scientists who have studied it have referred to the kinds of alterations, the kinds of impacts that tissue culture creates as genomic shock, that it induces genomic shock. That's not a very comforting word. That's why you don't hear it used by proponents. In fact, you don't even hear them talk about the need for tissue culture, because that throws the whole thing, all their precision is out the window anyway, because you can't predict tissue culture. You can't predict all of the disruptions that can happen. And even with back crossing, later on with the plant to try to get rid of many of them, you can't eliminate them all. So there are still going to be unintended consequences that could impose risks. And from the software standpoint, from the standpoint of computer science, any plants created that way have to be carefully, rigorously tested. And again, a lever of rigor that would bankrupt the system if it weren't implemented. So having crisped the claims about CRISPR, I think we're kind of at the point now where I think we can see why my initial claims were, even though they might have appeared not only bold but off the wall, are quite well supported from the standpoint of biological science and the standpoint of computer science. This massive venture to reconfigure the genetic core of the world's food supply is not only scientifically unsound, it is unacceptably risky. And the world will be far better off when the massive resources that have been and continue to be focused on advancing it are redirected to the safe and sustainable modes of agriculture that have already been demonstrated to be far more effective than genetic engineering and to be quite capable of meeting the world's nutritional needs. I can go into backing that up during the discussion period, but several scientists, in fact, I will just mention, because I should back this up, one of the biggest studies, most expansive, comprehensive studies on the future of agricultural technology, what kinds of agricultural programs are going to be needed to meet the foods nutritional needs for the next, I think, 30, 40, 50 years was conducted, was sponsored by four different United Nations agencies and the World Bank. And hundreds of scientists throughout the world participated. It was a multi-year study. It was published in 2008. More than 50 governments around the world have endorsed it. And one of its main findings was genetic engineering is not needed in order to feed the world's growing population. Not needed. And the study concluded what really is needed are what is agroecological techniques, and they lumped them together. But small, especially for the third world, small-scale agroecological sustainable techniques, said they will be more than capable, and we should be focusing on developing the strength of those programs. And when the director of that study was asked at the press conference announcing it, so do you see any significant role to be played by genetic engineering? He stated the simple answer is no. So we don't need them. And from a standpoint of biological science and computer science, they are unreasonably risky. So all we need is to get enough key people aware of the key facts. This whole venture will topple because it rests on a foundation of misinformation and rests on a foundation of practices that are contrary to science. So it is my hope that enough people will learn the facts, and certainly enough key people will learn them soon, so that all of the massive investment of money and resources will be redirected to where it should be, and the world will be far happier, healthier for it. Thank you very much.